So when we talk, and especially with people that we know less, my ego tend to take over and be like, I want to be the smartest person in the room, or I want to be this and that. And I invite everybody to self-explore. Try to understand where they're coming from. I don't know anyone who regretted doing this work.
You're listening to Living the Unseen, the podcast where Ariana and I explore how we can incorporate spirituality into our everyday lives.
We all have parts of ourselves that we like less. Most of us push those parts away. But our guest Remy Ribas Policastro did the exact opposite and committed to a lifelong loving relationship with those parts. In today's episode, we will talk about how breathwork, Vipassana meditation, and Ashtanga yoga help him on this journey. And for all you fellow language nerds out there, Tanya, Remy, and I do our very best to untangle the differences between spirituality, philosophy, and religion. Let's dive in. I would love to start our exploration of spirituality with you today with something you've shared with us just before our recording, and that was your birthday celebration. And I'm really curious because you mentioned that as an example of how you experience spirituality. So tell us about how is a birthday celebration something spiritual?
Okay. I think it can be, because it depends on what we put in the label of what is spiritual. But certainly bringing people together for a meal, I guess, is necessary, but bringing people together with all the rituals that goes around, with the cake, with the candles, with the singing, with the little speech and so on, all of that is not necessary. I mean, we could still have the dinner, the food, and our body will be nourished and we can go on with our lives. But adding that layer of, some would say it can be spiritual. And if you add that, like what you're celebrating is actually you spinning one more time around the sun, yeah, then it's bigger than the little human that is at the center of attention for the time of that dinner, if that makes sense.
And what were the moments in your actual birthday celebration and that of your partner that made you experience the spiritual?
I don't know how to answer this because we still haven't defined what is spiritual. So it's like, but for sure, like the high of having like tens of people around us, loved one that we have a relationship with, and it's emotionally it's quite intense. And so that intensity of sensations, I guess some would say it can be seen as spiritual, because there is no other reason than why, or I guess this is the meaning, the intention that we put on top that makes it so special, because at the end of the day, it's just a dinner. But yeah, it was, I mean, I've never done birthday descale of, because it was my wife and I, so we had like about 40 people. And so it was cute because people come from all bits of our lives, some from sports, some from activity, some from work, et cetera, et cetera. And so they all come together like a tiny wedding, so to speak. So it was very cute, but we need to define what is spiritual for me to answer more clearly and not just beat around the bush.
So it's really funny because with some of our podcast guests, they're totally okay with not defining it and just talking about what the experiences are. But with you and your inner philosopher, we're not getting away without a definition, right? So let's give it a try, and we're happy to share too. But maybe you can kick us off with what your for now best definition of spirituality is.
Ooh. So I looked it up, and it's basically everything that is related to the human spirit or soul and not related to the material and something else world. So I guess the unseen is everything that is related to the unseen, as you titled it, is a good way, is a definition that I would live by and I would be okay with. The problem is For me, it's mostly nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
And then language put on top is a very imperfect proxy to relate that experience. But that's me. What is your definition, Ayana? And what is your definition, Tanya?
I guess it has to do with connection for me. And that is also why I can relate to birthdays and other celebrations having a spiritual component, because there is this minefield, especially with birthdays, of the materialistic stuff that is attached to like giving gifts and receiving gifts, and also the part of like putting yourself at the center of attention, which sometimes feels weird, right? I mean, some people don't love it, some people do. But I think when I think about my own birthdays and thinking about whether I would say this is a spiritual act for me, what I think is happening is that you're seeing yourself on a, like when you zoom out, in a connection to other people on a scale of like what is happening to your lifetime, like where are you in your lifespan. It's a moment of reflection, which makes it spiritual for me. It has to do with introspection and connection, I would say. That's like my working definition right now. Ask me again tomorrow.
And it's a good point that you're making about language, because this is one of the reasons that I've always held back when it comes to talking about spirituality, is because the moment you start putting words to it, it sounds so superficial and flat and cliche. And that's also why we love doing this podcast, is to help us find words. And one of the best ways to find these words, I believe, is to talk about these actual experiences. And for us now to explore, why is a birthday, or why can a birthday be something spiritual? By using these examples, I feel like we can make it more tangible than by looking up the dictionary meaning of the word spirituality, because it stays so abstract and I don't feel anything, right? When you say, oh, it's not... What was the definition you found? It's not about the materialistic, it's about the unseen. It's like, okay, I don't know what to do now, right? But when you talk about your birthday party and spending time with these people that mean a lot to you, and making a meal, you were cooking together also, right? Doing something together. And then, you know, if I walk into that kitchen where you were cooking together, I would just see people make a meal. I make meals every day. What's special about that? But what I would feel is an incredible amount of love, probably. What I would feel is the connection that Tanya was talking about earlier. And that is the unseen. And that's what, to me, makes it spiritual. I feel like love and spirituality in a way are very connected, are somehow the closer you move to love and to true connection. For me, that feels like a path to spirituality. And this also means that, you know, me working as a coach, a lot of the work I do is helping other people be more authentic and show up more authentically, which helps me show up more authentically. And when I think about why I do that, it is because then I can move closer to love, and I can move closer to feeling a connection to others, to nature, to, you know, anything really, which doesn't feel very concrete, but feels very important to me.
Interesting. What's funny is that I think I'm almost sure that we're all talking about the same thing. And then it just shows how, like, our relationship with language, with self-expression, with identity, and this is what, like, blurs the line in how we are capable of communicating it or expressing it. But we all experience it the same way, I guess.
That sometimes if you label it as spiritual, it can either create more closeness to people or more distance. Because some people, if you labeled your birthday party as like, we're going to have a spiritual dinner in honor of our birthdays, I don't know. I mean, I don't know your friends, but I don't know how many of those would have showed up, and some would maybe excuse have excused themselves, right? And I think like sometimes
It's really interesting what it does when you label things as spiritual. And you also mentioned the term philosophical at some point, like, and being more comfortable maybe with the term like philosophy versus spirituality. So why do you think you're more comfortable with this term, if I even understand that correctly, than with the term spiritual?
So with all the deconstruction that I am trying to do daily, it shows how I'm still what the collection of experiences and education that I've received as a French person and educated in the French system. It's a very secular education that I received, and it never hit me, because like, how do you know the water is wet as a fish, right? So it only hit me when I started traveling and study abroad. And it's funny, because in English, for example, I use God or Jesus as an expression that I would never do so in French. So it just shows how we like take language for what it is, for what it means. And underneath, it might be completely disconnected from the actual words or the actual reaction that we're going to create in other people. But anyway, so philosophy makes me a lot more comfortable, because born and raised as French, religion is tend to be seen as something that goes, that is a danger to freedom, to construction of a society, of a nation. Because this is basically what we receive as an education in France. Because when we are taught the history of France, this is a big turning point where we decided to separate property-wise, politically, etc., the church and the all religions from the political aspect of it. So philosophy is a lot less loaded. That would be for my French side. Then I guess on a more individual or personal side, a person that had a significant influence on me is a grandfather of mine, who was a philosophy teacher. And I did spend a lot of time, especially in my teenagers, and he exposed me to knowledge, to books, to theories, to concepts that I wouldn't have otherwise. So he made me, even if I didn't realize it at the time, he made me more accustomed to philosophical terms than spiritual terms. And he was like, what would be the drastically anti-religion of any form. So I guess I still have some trace of that in my... And I don't know about you, but religion and spirituality tend to be very intertwined, at least in how I map out this concept. And so that's why philosophy, I feel a lot more comfortable. And philosophy feels a lot more open.
Hmm.
You can be wrong, because it's theoretical. So it's discourse. What makes me uncomfortable with religion and to some extent with spirituality is that there is one truth, and that we can verbalize it with our tiny little words, and that's it. Whoever wrote stuff a few thousand years ago, that's the truth. That makes me very uncomfortable. And with philosophy, you don't have that. Like concepts evolve, new concepts emerge, and they construct each other, they nourish each other. So it's a lot more flexible as a field, if that makes sense.
It's super interesting, because if you look at the word philosophy, if I'm not mistaken, it means a friend of wisdom, right?
Mm.
I think.
Okay.
Yeah. And it, like, wisdom, if I hear the term philosophy, I think it's somewhere up in my brain. Like, my brain is very engaged. It has to do with language, with discourse, with like getting to the deeper truth of things. But if you hear wisdom, depending on how you define it, it can include, and that's for me part of the journey, the wisdom of the body. And we'll talk maybe about breath work at some point, because that's a topic that is very near and dear to your heart, right? But if you include the wisdom of the body, then for me, they're not so far apart, right? Because I think there is no spirituality when you exclude the bodily sensations in a way. I think for me, at least, that is a part that is not, that you cannot exclude that on that journey. But if you heard the term religion, for me, that is also not something where I associate like the body is involved necessarily. Actually, in parts of the religion, the body is something that is also stigmatized as like the flesh, and it's like something that is negative, right? So it's very interesting mm-hmm. to see, like, for me, when brain and body, mind and body, soul and body, when all of that comes together, then for me it becomes a holistic and therefore spiritual experience. But that is just my personal take. I mean, there might be people who say, like, with meditation, you actually are like you stop thinking and you're just in the body. For some people, it might be combining different aspects. But I think it's very interesting if you look at these different terms, religion, philosophy, and spirituality, how much is wisdom involved and how much is the wisdom of the mind versus the wisdom of the body involved? Just something that came up while I was listening to you.
Interesting. I look, you see, I agree with everything you said. That's it. So, Ayana, anything else to add? Because, yeah, I think this is a mic drop.
No. I think what I realized while listening is that for me, one of the ways I judge how the podcast recordings are going is how much I am in my body. Because for me, even these recordings and exploring this with other people is a spiritual experience in itself. So for me, that embodied part is really important. And I was raised without any form of religion, so I don't have like big things against it. I also know very little. So it's one of the things I want to explore in this podcast, because I see people doing really beautiful things because of their religion. So I'm really curious about that experience and how religion works in today's world, right? Because I probably have an outdated version of it in my system. So yeah, but I find it really interesting how words change, how comfortable we are with the conversation. Because if I would have started this conversation asking you about philosophy, it would have been easier for you to open up. So it's really, I find that really interesting. And what I'm curious about is to hear a bit more about your journey, because you started to say like one of your grandfathers inspiring you with philosophy and your travels connecting you to a different way of maybe a less rational way of connecting with the world. So what have been pivotal moments in your spiritual philosophical journey?
Well, I guess it's going to circle on what Tanya was saying about the body, because until very recently, all of my learnings were very intellectual. Everything was verbalized. I was certain about many things, and I was doubting very few, if any. And most likely, if I was doubting something, it's just because I didn't think hard enough about it. So I had that like certainty. And then my body showed me that I was doing many things wrong and certainly taking care of it. And it was the first step into, yeah, it was basically the first time that I faced the hard truth that I was wrong. And it took me like 33 years to be wrong, to feel wrong anyway. And from there, there was a lot of self-exploration, many through bodily practices. You've mentioned breathwork was definitely one of them, but it appeared much later. I've done a lot of yoga before, Ashtanga, not to name it. And yes, experiencing things and feeling things, because I was just so, I was so in my head and intellectualizing everything that I actually wasn't feeling anything. And hence my body not taking care of my body, because how do you know what to do when you don't feel? And it was, yeah, it was so step by step. Obviously, I didn't know where I was going. So it happened in 2020. I read a book that really like washed me up. It's Bernard Moitessier. He's one of the first person who circumnavigate around the world. And he wrote a book about sailing around the world. He did the first Vendée Globe. And incredible guy. I don't know if we can digress in his life, but this guy is nuts. I mean, that's on in a good way. But the way he described the relationship with his boat, I was like, that's it. This is the relationship that I should have with my body. Because there is that codependency. Ocean, I was sailing quite a bit at the time, and ocean is a very hostile place if you're not on your boat. So you codepend on one another. So that fits quite well, the relationship with the body. There is a codependence. And so you need to both protect it when there is a storm. So take out the excess of sail. And on the contrary, you can, when it's sunny and with a nice breeze, you can push it yet by listening to the sounds he makes, the feels of the tension in the rope, how the sails are shaped, etc. So it's the metaphor I thought was fitting quite nicely with the body. And the name of the body is called, the name of the ellipsis, the name of the boat is called Joshua. And so I called my body Joshua from then. And so I started talking a lot, the journaling a lot in the dialogue format with Joshua. And then I realized that if we are here together and to live together, we might as well love each other. So little by little, we started to fall in love with one another and bought a ring to propose him. And I had the ring on me for 6 months. Because I didn't find the perfect moment to propose. And yeah, after 6 months, I proposed my body to get married. And interestingly enough, he was in the house of that grandfather, where I was alone during a few days in summer. It's in the middle of France, beautiful. And so we got engaged. And then 6 months later, we got married, with my little sister officiating the ceremony. And yeah, it was really cool. And this is, until now, a very fruitful, not easy, like any marriage, I guess, a relationship with my buddy.
It touches me very deeply. I think I've heard of one other story of someone who married themselves, basically, after a divorce. She decided to marry herself, and she's like giving herself flowers every 2 weeks and also celebrating the anniversaries. But I think the thing making it about the body also, like, especially for me as a woman, I feel like there is like the hours in my life I've spent like wrestling with this body and like trying to alter it and trying to make it smaller or like look different, or I don't know, like I think this kind of embracing it with everything it is, that sounds like, for me, sounds like the final frontier and something that I wish we all could do. And I wonder what has changed for you since you did that. And also, what were the difficult parts about it? Because it sounds awesome now that you've made up your mind and you did it. But I think, like, with every partner, right, there are parts that we want to change, right? Or that we haven't made peace with, right? Where we envy others, maybe, and so on. So how does that translate to this very special relationship to your body, if you want to share, since you also compared it to a relationship and you even have a name for it now? That's awesome.
Well, so I picked a name, and I wanted to marry, because I wanted to challenge also my heteronormative identity, I guess. So I like the idea of having a husband, because yeah, I thought it would. Anyway, so yes, it's not easy, and it's been 3 and 4 years, and it's still, yes, a learning curve. What I did, so I mean, here we don't have any, it's my belief, but my belief is that thoughts, or the thoughts that are emerging, are effectively the body. So when I have thoughts, they are never mine, they are Joshua's, because I've never asked them to be here. So initially, distancing myself from my body or from Joshua was a way to distance myself from anything that I haven't asked to be there in the first place. Because there are tons of it. Like you said, changing your body, or we've never asked for a body, yes, yet it is this one. So why distancing allowed me to not take it so at core, because it's not me, it's another person. So it helped me to be more composed or in assessing its needs, its limitation, etc., and also communicate with my wife. She has her own alter ego, and we communicate in this four-way conversation all the time. So, you know what Joshua just told me, and then we cut the joke. Yeah, and because what you say about not wanting your body to or having it, you can say the same about your thoughts. Like if we dig deep enough, all of us, we are in some way racist, sexist, and all the ist. But how? So putting it to somebody else helped me to get rid of the guilt, because like it's not me. Like I've never asked to be racist, yet sometimes I can tell my nervous system or my body or my thoughts or leaning towards that, distancing myself and yet taking responsibility over it with the relationship. A bit like kids, I guess, because I don't have any. And then obviously with patience and work, we can impact both our bodies, our minds. And I just find it very manipulable as a concept to like distance and yet own it.
It also reminded me of something else, like, because this is also a very powerful concept in organizations. When I do consulting work, and I work a lot with product managers, right? And they are very stretched thin in between different stakeholders and so on. And sometimes it really helps when you make them realize like how many hats they're wearing, like all the different roles, right? And then also to let them speak from these different roles. And again, and you and I, we do this in our friendship also sometimes, right? You say like, I'm putting my coaching hat on, and now I'm putting my friend hat on again, right? So to realize like, okay, from which role and which capacity am I speaking right now? And for me, it's like, I don't know if I got that correctly, but for me, that is kind of, you can own a role and take responsibility for it, but it does not fully define you, right? And it's not you. And it's a bit complex in relationship to the body, right? Because I still find it a bit hard to not take ownership for my thoughts and think they're not me. But at the same time, I get where you're coming from. And I've heard this several times, like, we are not our thoughts. And it's true. Yeah. So it's really powerful. And I was just thinking, like, but that's a really bad joke. Like, I think with you and your wife having these alter egos, I was just thinking, that's the closest people will ever get to having a foursome.
Okay, I'm not going to comment on this, but yes, it's one of the perks.
What I'm curious about on a more serious level, who does Joshua have a relationship with? So in other words, how do you experience the self? Is it the soul or what? Yeah, what is Remy when it's not your body, when it's not your thoughts?
So to make it simple, I tend to say that Joshua is everything that I didn't ask for. If I was to pick a menu and be like, I want a bit of this, a bit of that, and so on, Joshua is everything else. So he's my fears, he's my doubts, mm-hmm. He is any disturbing or challenging or uncomfortable thoughts, he is them. And actually, I would go as far as, so he's my mind, I guess. And I would say that my mind is actually a verbalization of my body. And I would see a correlation, at least, between how I feel and how I think. And I guess a lot of people, if you do any challenging practice physically, whether it's cold exposure or breathing, at the beginning, when the sensation is uncomfortable, thoughts are racing and they are not nice. So yes, I Joshua is everything that I didn't ask for. And I can see my body improving, and I have pains that have disappeared, even though I'm working out and I'm pushing it way further than it ever did. But through proper training and listening to limitation and reinforcing certain areas and stuff, I can see that my mind as well is a lot polished or kinder. Or now Joshua has a relationship with everything, but it always goes through me. Or sometimes it can bypass me. And this is like, we've all experienced that when we lose it, basically, when words are coming out and we wish we didn't. Well, that's Joshua. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm escaping my responsibility, but at least I can verbalize it that way. And it also helps with other people to deep dive straight into like pretty sensitive topics in the action. So we have often conversation with my wife saying, hey, Joshua is a bit pissed off about what Paola, so Paola is her Joshua, about Paola just said. And I get why she said that, because this, this, and that, but that really pissed off Joshua. And she's like, oh, yeah, shit, I didn't realize. Oh, but yeah, because of this and that. And so you're talking to other people, so you can brainstorm on the situation a lot better than when there is like identity or direct identity involved, if that makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense. And it's, I think now that you explained it more, I think I have an even more complicated version of that. I didn't marry the other parts, but the way I see myself and all humans is really consisting of all these different parts. And my husband and I do the same. We have names for specific areas even. The most famous one is a part of mine called Hank. And Hank is always in competition with my husband professionally.
Okay.
Which is horrible to have in a relationship, right? Why would I want to compete with my husband? Makes no sense. But Hank is very convinced that that's a thing. So I can tell him, you know, whenever he achieves something, I'll say, okay, Hank is a little bit upset about this. I'm very happy for you. But if you notice that I'm not as happy as I should be, it's because of Hank. And then he gets why I'm not expressing the full joy he would expect from his wife.
That's awesome. And I love how playful it can get. And I think that's also one of the things we're looking for in spirituality, especially Arianna and I, like, how can this be less serious and also more playful? And just for full disclosure, I also have several parts, and one of them, we talked about it yesterday, is a Professor McGonagall from Harry Potter, like the super serious, like, you gotta do your homework kind of thing. And even my kids get to call me out on it because they're starting to read Harry Potter now. And so they're like, you're all Professor McGonagall today. So dial it down a notch. So it's really, really cool to make that also a fun and playful way to call out parts that are taking over, going rogue, like you call it, Arianna, at some point.
And I think this is so important, because if you don't say it, it's still there. Like, if you don't tell, sorry, I'm jumping back to what Ayana is saying. If you don't say to your husband, he can still feel it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the worst that can happen is like, no, what are you talking about? Of course not. I'm happy for you. And still, it's not like what is actually happening. Mm. And then we dive into denial, and it creates like massive distance between the people. So communicating that way for me is a very important tool, at least to cut the noise and get real. And for convenience, all of these Hank, Professor McGonagall, and like, they are under one persona. And I'm using Joshua, like, he's very competitive. And so when I go to the gym or workout or whatever, I totally use Joshua. Or when I do breath work, I use him against himself. Because that's the beauty of, yeah.
How? Tell us about that.
Because he loves to push, like, he's just extreme in every sense.
Yeah,
he's an Ashtanga, a Vipassana, or breathwork, or one of these practices that you want to get intense. Well, be my guest, but it's gonna work even better. So this is one of these practices where we can use our ego, if you want to use that word, or I use Joshua against himself, because I use him to push, and eventually, through pushing, we self-regulate ourselves. We release nervous system or emotional tension or load. And then he is obviously more quiet.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, because what you're saying, Ashtanga yoga or Vipassana, they're the hardcore things, right? It's not like, let's do a loving kindness meditation. It's like, let's be quiet for 10 days. Let's do this daily yoga practice that's very rigid also in how things are done. So a risk I could see with that, if Joshua is doing the practice for you, is that what it feels like for me is that you could still do that with the mind. Like, you might not go into the experience so much. That's when I project what if Hank would do a Vipassana retreat, what that would look like, is I'll just show people that I can sit more still than they can. I will show people that I will have more profound experience than they have. Missing out on the whole opportunity of what the Vipassana retreat could mean for me, or what the daily Ashtanga practice could do for me. So how do you use Joshua against himself in a healthy way and not in the Hank way I was just talking about?
No, but the Hank way would work as well. Because this is the beauty of these practice. If you practice them seriously with a discipline, they work. So even if you get the discipline or that seriousness from a sense of competition, it works. Because if you do sit completely still, which is called adityana in Vipassana, that meditation of making zero movement, it works. And so you regulate your nervous system, and it's hard. So then it's like, how do we do the hard things? And I think using ego is, or Joshua or whatever, or Hank, or is a perfectly valid way to do the hard things. Because we have that urge, we have that drive anyway, that, so if we channel it towards the right things and it self-regulate itself, I guess it's,
so what you're saying,
it's a win-win.
If I can paraphrase, what you're saying is how we get there is up to, in this case, Joshua or Hank or whoever, like whatever part is currently running our system, but the outcome will still be beneficial. So basically, if, I don't know, I am like naturally drawn to organizing my whole life in spreadsheets. If I create a spreadsheet about like how often I did my whatever yoga practice or how many minutes I sat still this day, because that's just what I'm naturally inclined to. It doesn't sound like fun. It doesn't look very spiritual to do this on a spreadsheet, but if it gets me to being more still, the outcome will still be beneficial. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I don't know if I can scale this ID, but at least for me, this is what happened. I did my first Vipassana because it was hard. And when I was telling people that I was going to do a Vipassana, I knew I had a sense of respect. And it was, looking back, it was a terrible way to enter Vipassana, but it was the only way. And I still like ripped so much benefit. It probably made it harder, because 10 days is long, so and it is designed actually to dissolve your ego. So if you go with your ego, the dissolution will be like, you will fall from higher. But whatever it takes to get you there, and this is why, yeah, I think this is why I'm particularly attached to these practices, intense physical like Ashtanga or breath work, is that this is a space where I can use that internal drive or violence.
Your dog is doing breath work.
Yeah, that's it. I'm a senior.
Yes, this is one of these practices where if you just do it all in, it will work. And this is also why I teach breath work. So maybe we can have attention in that, because I found it so effective. And this is undeniable. Like, it just works. Especially with that sense of like competition or doing extra hard or 1% more than any other, whatever. It works even more.
What was your first encounter with breath work?
So after buying the ring with Joshua, my life is a bit of a cliche, but this is like really cliche. I bought the ring to Joshua in India when I was doing a monthly training of Ashtanga in an ashram. And then I loved it so much. And being in India, that I stayed there for a couple of more months. I started teaching yoga in India. And eventually, randomly, I bump into a guy walking in the street. And the guy was like, do you want to do breath work? But the whole shebang, the guy with the beard, the sarouel, the, yeah. And I was like, breath what? Breath work, Wim Hof, holotropic, whatever. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. And I was with somebody that I met a couple of days before in a cafe. And she was like, yeah, let's do it. It's going to be fun. And that's exactly what happened. I went all like, what is this thing? Sure, this is a hippie, whatever. I'm going to nail it. And I did it. And it completely blew me out of my mind. So I went back the second day. I did it again. And the third day, I was like, you need to teach me this. Like, this is. Wow. And I started teaching like that.
What kind of, because breath work is a term that we just throw out there, but what is it? What did you do with, what did this bearded guy do with you?
So with music, that is giving that sense of momentum, and it's rounds of hyperventilation with breath holds empty at the end. And that's it. And then you can add whatever ritual around, or but the practice is this, and it works. Two main reasons, at least what we know, is that first we create an excitation of the nervous system that is rather uncommon in our day-to-day lives, and yet our nervous systems are designed to take this load. We have in some differences, but our nervous system is quite similar to other mammals. And so this is designed to, oh, shoot, there is a tiger. Let's run and then switch off and rest and digest. Now, the problem is in our day-to-day, we don't have that shift from one to the other because there is no tiger. It's just an email or an Uber that is being late or a spilled coffee. And there's tiny little aggressions or not strong enough to generate a shift, but they still add on. And so we define a new reality of staying in our sympathetic nervous system. And so by exciting our nervous system to this level, that even doing intense activities like CrossFit or so on, we actually can't, because we're still in a control of a movement, and doing laying down is very critical to really go all in, truly. And so we excite ourselves to a point that effectively our body realizes that it can relax afterwards. So we shift and we strengthen that shift ability that we naturally have, but we tend to lose between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system state. And then the other thing we do with the breath hold at the end is we play around with our tolerance to CO2 in our blood. And there is maybe not a causation, but at least a correlation between perceived level of anxiety and level of CO2 in our body. And this is why people with an amygdala dysfunction that cannot experience fear, the only way you can make them experience fear to the highest level, I guess, is to make them breathe a mixture that is mostly CO2. And you would scare them to death. It would last only a couple of seconds, but they would experience fear. And the reason is, it's because that high, or at least we can speculate that that high level of CO2 in our system makes us experience fear and at a lower dose, anxiety. And so, but it's all very subjective. If you breath hold right now, you would probably feel the urge to breathe with your CO2 rising to, with your oxygen lowering to 90 or 85%. So it's still plenty, a lot to go. And we actually react more to CO2 rising up. And so when we hyperventilate for long rounds, we exhale a lot of CO2, we lower our level of CO2. And then when we breath hold, it slightly climbs up again. And then we do it again and then again. And so we allow our body to be more less responsive to fluctuation of CO2. And so less anxious.
It's very interesting what you just said, because I did a holotropic breathwork once and I'm trying to map my experience to what you just said. And in my case, I didn't know what I signed up for. It was just an intuitive decision. And so I found myself in a room with, like, I think 9 other women and 2 women leading like this kind of ceremony. And basically, I've never been in the state of hyperventilation before, at least not intentionally. And I was also going through a very intense phase of like understanding a lot of trauma from the past. But basically what happened is, like, in this room, like, there were people hysterically laughing. There were people crying. It sounded like a room full of women giving birth at the same time. Like, the level of noise was insane, right? And I was like in the middle of this and, like, yeah, also part of it in a way, right? And after that, I thought, like, what the hell was this? Like, it was really like the closest I came to like what it feels like to take drugs, maybe. But it, in a way, like, also released a lot of things. Like, in my case, very deep spiritual encounter. And for me, it was like I met my twin that was never born. And in that session, I felt like I was holding this little tiny human's hand, right? And I, like, the body was very involved in the sensation, but for me, it had no purpose of, like, maybe making my body more resilient, lowering my anxiety. For me, I experienced it as something that brought me closer to, like, experiences that I was suppressing in my body, but that were stored somewhere. So I'm trying to map that to your experience of breath work. And where does this, like, categorize as breath work? And yeah, maybe you can say something about it.
Well, thank you for sharing. And so what you experience is how we should experience reality. Now, the problem is we most of us have an unregulated or dysregulated nervous system. And so for basically releasing that emotional load that is done through heightening or your nervous system activity, then you can tap into your parasympathetic. And in your parasympathetic state, this is when you can experience reality, truly. Mm-hmm. You have insights that are coming up. You have trauma that are being released. You have all of these things that our body are normally designed to do, because this is what they do. They recover and grow. But this really happens if we first regulate our nervous system. So maybe these words is triggering because it sounds very medically. And so we miss the bridge. Like, how do we go from this medical explanation-ish to this spiritual experience? Then this is the miracle of consciousness. We don't know where it is. We don't know what it is, but we can still experience it.
What was your experience? Regulated we are,
Yeah. And the more regulated we are, the more we can experience it. And this is what any other practice, with Vipassana, with Ashtanga, at the end of an Ashtanga session, when you are in Savasana, this is your nervous system that has been regulated, and you experience what we should be experiencing in our day-to-day lives.
I was just curious to see how that maps to your mental model of breath work, because that's my only experience. I never looked into it from a scientific point of view. And like, that's just all I can say about it, but I just wanted to drop it here. Thank you.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me that that you're creating space to accessing the information that is already there, but that you're just, you know, too constricted to receive, basically. And I was very curious what your first breathwork session, what the experience was for you that made you so hooked to this.
Well, it was undeniable. Hmm. I cried, and I had no explanation for it. And the way I felt afterwards, this is how I wanted to feel. It became a baseline, basically. Hmm. And so it became, yeah, I guess my North Star. I mean, doing Ashtanga and teaching Ashtanga before kind of was already pointing in the same direction, but there it was like so undeniable, basically.
Can you describe it more? Like, what was different after that session? How did you walk through the world?
It's like, I guess, getting glasses for the first time. Or you see in 4D, like the you hear words differently, you see thoughts differently, you see them coming with a lot more control agency, you're a lot more present. And for me, this is what happens when we regulate our nervous system. And to circle again on what you were saying about being playful, I think breathwork is the most quintessential way to be playful. At least this is what I try to convey. I make people dance before. Do you know Pump the Jam? This is a techno trance. Yeah, exactly. So that's the most ridiculous song, but it's so catchy. Nobody knows what it means, etc. Yeah. So the warm up for me is just in the dark, 3 minutes of this song, and people are dancing facing the wall.
Yeah.
That's it. And there is a bit of resistance after. So it's just about getting the heart rate up and like getting rid of the little bit of anxiety that is building up on like getting into a new space with somebody that they don't know and experiencing something for the first time. There is that little like tension that we're building up on. So I make the move so that they get rid of that little tension and they can get into the breathing as smoothly as possible. Because without that first tension, it's a lot easier. And then the breathing is breathe in, breathe out. I give a lot of energy. But I try to use as little words as possible and certainly not loaded words. So it's very practical. Because I'm especially in at the beginning, maybe Tanya, you can comment on this, but at the beginning of a breathwork session, there is tremendous resistance from the mind that is coming up to the surface. Self-doubt, and I'm not doing it right, this is not working, what are these sensations, they would stay forever, et cetera, et cetera. And the mind will grab anything that is coming up. So the music that I use are without lyrics, and I'm trying to sanitize my language as much as possible so that I don't give the mind of people doing it grip on anything, basically. And then it works. And the people after are just a little closer from the version that they would like to be.
Yeah, because for reference, you do this work with companies, right? It's not what Tanya experienced, individuals going to a session, or what I've experienced working one-on-one with someone that guides you through breath work. You go into companies, let them dance to that wonderful song, and then invite them to have this profound experience, which I think is really, really cool and really gives me hope for the future of business, actually, that there's an openness to experience this. And I think your way of, approaching this almost as a fitness routine of like, you just need to breathe better and then you'll do better, you'll perform better. It's very inviting. What was the first time you did this with a company? How did that go?
So actually, the first time was with Moita, with the Product Weekend. Last year at Productize, he invited me to held a session for his executive retreat. But it wasn't a company, as in it wasn't coworkers. It was people brought together in a professional settings, but still, they were anonymous to one another. And then the second time, it was this time for a proper corporate setting with a team at Cofidis. This is a fintech company. And the manager came to one of my sessions and she's like, this is it. This is what I'm looking for. So she brought her team to a session. We organized it and she didn't tell anything to anyone. She kept it mysterious because it was part of a offsite day where she wanted to map out the year and there was a lot of brainstorming and workshop to happen. So she wanted to get rid of everything that the last year and start fresh, basically. So she used breathwork for this. And actually, it makes tons of sense but I only realized this afterwards, that when we are trying to build teams, we are effectively looking at bringing individuals together. So finding that balance between respecting and protecting that individuality, yet melting what can be into a bigger entity. A team. And breathwork, especially in a group settings, does exactly this. This is a very introspective individual practice. Yet, doing it in group means that people will experience the same music at the same time, not necessarily the same sensations, because our nervous system reacts very specifically at an individual level to music, etc. But it's basically like going to a concert with strangers. When you meet a stranger and you were to the same concert or to the same university, all of a sudden the nervous system connects on something because you have that common ground. And breathwork, just that. It's a profound experience. That experience in group is a very bounding experience. Then with a regulated nervous system, people are able to be vulnerable, humble, better listeners, all sorts of stuff that none of them are a problem to building more, let's put it out there, productive or performing or competitive teams.
Sounds to me like you're creating psychological safety that way, which is, you know, something that is often perceived as, oh, this is fluffy and extra, but it's actually the core of what makes team more effective and work better together and enjoy working together more. So it's really, yeah, like a superpower when you give teams this ability to access that in a relatively short amount of time.
So, 100%. That's exactly it.
Yeah. Hey, and we're coming towards the end of our conversation already. I'm really curious, after exploring all the things that we explored in this conversation, what are things that you feel we haven't touched upon or things you would like to emphasize to wrap up our exploration?
No, I think we are pretty on par. I don't feel any missing part anywhere. So no, I'm very pleased with a wonderful time.
How's Joshua doing now?
Joshua, he became a kitten over the last, yeah. Now he has some bursts every now and then, but yeah, he's getting cuter and cuter. Okay. So when we talk, and especially with people that we know less, obviously or Joshua or Igo tend to take over and be like, I want to be the smartest person in the room, or I want to be this and that, and I guess I can finish with the message of, yeah, I invite everybody to self-explore and meet their Joshua, whoever that is. Try to understand where they're coming from, because they come from somewhere. And I don't know anyone who regretted doing this work.
Thank you for listening to Living the Unseen, the podcast in which Ariana and I explore the role of spirituality in everyday life. Stay tuned for our next episodes to meet more inspiring guests and hear more anecdotes from our personal lives to inspire your own spiritual journey. And if you want to dive deeper, we invite you to sign up for our newsletter on our website, livingtheunseen.com, to read more about our podcast guests, hear our personal reflections on the episodes, and be the first one to know when a new episode comes out. And lastly, we are immensely grateful for your support. If you enjoy our content, we would love for you to rate us with 5 stars on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us reach more listeners and gives Ariana and me some extra motivation on our podcast journey. Until next time, and keep living the unseen.